You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. I guess the most Jewish guy who's ever been on screen. I'm not entirely sure. It's hard to say.
He was giving Woody Allen a run for his money.
He really was here, yeah. But a very different type of representation of this culture, to be sure.
No, definitely. I think, I guess it's inevitable that he'd be compared to Woody Allen as the most famous, you know, one of the most famous.
Who was playing a character who's very much a part of his culture.
Very much so. But he sort of lost that whenever he got, like, really sort of, you know, deep and pathetic. In a way,
it's just so plain goofy. Oh, you mean this movie?
Yeah, this movie,
which is like starts off as kind of feeling like, well, I guess this is kind of like a stomach clencher of a comedy.
It's a lot of things. I kept on. Yeah. Yeah.
But it shifted tones a lot. It actually more often than not worked because it is largely a character study. It is. It does have its certain moments of cringe comedy and social commentary and political satire, and then in the last half, it kind of becomes a bit of a political thriller.
Yes,
but this we're talking about Norman, which or the full title of which is, I believe, Norman: the Moderate Rise and Tragic Fall of a New York Fixer, played by Richard Gere. And I have to say, I can't remember the last time I saw a movie with Richard Gere. I can't remember the last time I saw a movie and I wanted to go see it that he happened to be in. Mm. So I hadn't seen him in a while. And Richard Gere had always struck me as kind of a perfectly capable leading man, but a bit dull, a bit sort of generic. This is actually the best thing I've ever seen him do. And maybe I've said...
Come on now, Chicago?
I've never seen Chicago because not a musical guy.
Oh, it's so great.
So I'd always had kind of a low bar as far as Richard Gere is concerned. So I really wasn't giving him much thought until he shows up, and he actually does, I think, a very credible job. I mean, yes, he kind of leans into the Jewish parody at times, but it's more often than not subtle, and I think it's very effective for this character because Norman is the sort of guy who, if he is talking to somebody who is Jewish and wants to play on their, you know, affiliation with Jewish causes, he kind of leans into it a little bit. He kind of lays it on. The interesting thing about this character and why I think it works for Gere is, like I said, I always found him kind of dull and surface level. And that is actually very good for this character, who is very much a surface character. Mm-hmm. You never really get to see what's really ticking under this guy till later on in the film. And even then, I believe that he's somewhat vague on purpose and is defined by everybody around him. He's the sort of guy who... You know when everybody says, oh, I know a guy who knows a guy?
Yeah.
Norman is that guy who knows the guy.
And that's, as near as we can tell, like his entire reason for existing.
Absolutely.
I mean, in fact, this is the character that ultimately, and they even say it at one point in the third act of the film, we know nothing about.
Yeah.
We don't know where he lives. We don't know how he lives.
That's on purpose. You know? He wants.
That's not a criticism. That's definitely like part, like I said, the characters themselves comment on like, who is this fucking guy?
Yeah.
Who, like... When you see him, you're like, okay, you don't expect the kind of movie that you'll end up getting. At first, he's like he's a schmuck. He's going around, he's giving out his card to everyone he can. He's like, he's a consultant. And clearly he's trying to get closer to this guy, Misha Eschel, played by Lior Ashkenazi. Boy, that's on the nose.
I have to type that out, I think, that's for my review. That'd be fun.
And because he's like the deputy... Something.
He's like the deputy minister.
He's like seven down the line from the prime minister of Israel. And he's like, oh, this is a guy. And he's practically, he's stalking this guy in an attempt to get close to him. And in fact, does get close to him, finds the perfect opportunity when he sees him admiring a pair of expensive shoes in a storefront window and uses his gift of gab, such as it is, to get close to this guy, follow him in there, and then ends up saying, you know what? Because he's like, oh, because I can't buy these shoes. They're too expensive. He's like, you know what? I'm going to buy these these shoes for you. I'm going to do this for you because I think they'd look great on you. And thus really starts the moment that the entire rest of this film hinges mm-hmm. upon, as like, he's fully expecting this to be a thing that, you know, moves him up the social ladder in the Jewish community. And it really doesn't at first, because there's a lot of people trying to set up barriers as we move into the second act, where Eshel has become the prime minister of Israel and he can't get a message through to this guy. He's kind of given up trying on the whole. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, I bet you if I could just talk to him, he would remember me and would be like, oh. And there's this wonderful moment where, you know, he's doing like a signing and like there's people there waiting in line.
Yeah.
And his friend or his nephew, played by Michael Sheen, who's a lawyer, is like, well, you know, you should go up to get in line, talk to him. And he's like, I don't know if I should. He doesn't want to be disappointed by not being remembered. I mean, I've been there where it's like, oh, a celebrity I had a couple of really positive experiences with 10 years ago. And now here's a chance to talk to him again. I don't even want to talk to him because they probably won't remember me. Yeah. And that'll just feel like,
you know, kill whatever you
but sure enough, he gets up there and immediately he's like, oh my god, it's you, where have you been, I miss you, my friend.
But I found that scene so heartwarming. I teared up because I thought, wow,
that's the key to Norman, because you spend most of the movie, everybody thinks, what is this guy's angle, is he trying to, you know,
he wants to be in the room.
I think he wants his little percentage, but he genuinely wants to help people. This is a guy who genuinely wants to feel important, connected, part of something.
It's more like, it's not even like, oh, I want to be rich. It's more like, I have something to offer, and I just want the opportunity to do it.
He wants validation. He wants validation from that specific level of people.
Yeah, or just, from his own people, where he's reduced to the point where, like, the best he can do is that he has a sort of friendship with Steve Buscemi, who's a local, pretty well-known and well-thought-of rabbi in New York City, who seems like he tolerates him more than anything else.
Yeah.
But as this goes on, everything goes into chaos when everyone, you know, sees in the community, my God, the prime minister of Israel just hugged this guy and insisted on him coming with them and staying up on stage and was like, whoa, he really likes him. And suddenly Richard Gere's life is thrown into chaos as everybody's like, well, now you can do favors for us. We accept you in part of the community now. And what do you do when that's not as true as it appears?
Right. Well, he promises more than he can deliver. But again, I never think Norman is deliberately trying to screw people.
No,
I think he's overly positive. He goes, yeah, of course he's going to take your call. Of course he's going to.
He's one of those people.
I'll get him to donate to the cause.
He's one of those who always wants to try and bring people together. That's his thing. He's constantly going, oh, let me introduce you to this person. I know that person. Even if there are things he really doesn't have to offer, he just thinks maybe he can figure out how to fix it so it happens.
Yeah.
But the problem is he's not a high-level fixer. No. He just thinks he'd be good at it if he was.
Yeah. He's never had the opportunity.
Well, that's his aspiration.
And ultimately, this is a weird tragedy about how a schmuck becomes a mensch, but at great cost. Yeah. You know, it's odd. It's not really a comedy,
but it is for me, because I think it is so many things. It's a drama. There were parts that were really, really tragic about it. It's also it's darkly, humorous. It also had the thriller aspect. Will he be able to pull this off? Will he, lose it all? But for me, all that, the movie is like Norman himself. He is all these different sort of, emotions and all these sort of tones within himself, for whoever is in front of him, at any given time. He is who he needs to be, which I kind of liked that.
Yeah. Norman is not he's not inherently a bad person.
No.
But I think it's very clear, and they do it subtly as they lay this movie out. You start to see that there is something almost borderline pathological about Norman.
No, he is a liar.
He's a liar.
But he's not lying for his own self-aggrandizement.
He's not lying for gain. And I think there's always the hope that he's going to pull it off. And one thing that really impressed me about this film, which was written and directed by a guy named Joseph Seder.
What else has he done?
I don't know. I had to look it up. I think he is an Israeli filmmaker. I think most of his films have been set in or around Israel.
It's a footnote, Beaufort, Campfire, and Time of Favor, none of which I've seen.
I haven't seen any of those either.
And one of the things he does here that I really expected this to be a kind of, grown-up story, kind of done with a flat sort of, Lifetime movie of the week look.
Sure.
One thing he does about halfway through, what Seder does is when we finally get that moment where Norman gets the validation he's always wanted. He meets the prime minister. Time literally stops.
Wasn't that great?
And all of a sudden, you know, you're treated to this montage of all these people that he's always wanted to talk to now are talking to him. People are asking who he is. Can they get his card? Now, where it gets interesting is that after that scene, we start seeing more and more. Most of this movie is shot with Gear talking to somebody on the phone.
Yeah.
He spends most of the time on the phone trying to get people
wandering around on the street.
Because as you realize, he doesn't have an office. He's constantly in the bus station. He's in a store. You know, he's constantly on the move.
He's chasing someone down.
But what the Cedar does that's very interesting is he actually had a combined scene. So you see Gear in the same room as the people he's talking to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a movie that's maybe 60% of phone conversations, it would get really boring to have that traditional standard, you know, we cut to this guy, then we cut to that guy, then we cut to this guy. Or maybe if you're being fancy, you do a screen split.
Here it was like a simulated screen split.
Yes, very much but so. They bled into each other in a way.
But it also functions thematically because that you get to see the world through Norman's pathology. There is an intimacy there that does not exist in anyone's mind but his own, where he might as well be in the room. He's like, oh, no, they're very good friends of mine. You know, someone he's only talked to on the phone, yet he feels like he's, you know, been invited into their home. And likewise, you see these people who, even though they dislike Norman, are willing to put up with him when they think he can benefit them.
Right.
But you can see him almost, even though he's miles away on a phone, he is literally invading their personal space.
Mm-hmm. They're aggravated they even have to deal with him.
But they put up with it because so long as they think they can use him.
It's kind of like
he's
that,
used more than he uses others.
It's kind of like that scene between the prime minister and his wife in bed.
Yeah, where she accuses him of, like, well, like, you think she's accusing him of, or like, Norman of being a user, and you realize she's not. She's accusing the prime minister of using Norman.
Yeah, he's only your friend when you need something.
Yeah, and you're like, wait, what? Yeah. And then it turns around where he's like, oh, no, wait, you're the one who's using Norman.
Didn't she just say, like, oh, when he could get our kid into Harvard?
Michelle, it would have been rude to refuse. Like, yeah, but you didn't say no, because there was a little bit of hope on your part that
there's
you could
some
pull it off.
Really interesting character turns like that in this.
Yeah.
And then those moments, and there's two. I mean, the thing you're talking about with the split screen really only happens in one sequence. But it goes on for a while, and it's one of the two big impressive visual sequences in this film that are odd in that the rest of the film isn't made that way at all. The one you're talking about, Frank, where you're like right after he meets the prime minister, is that weird montage, spacey, trippy montage of everyone
in his
coming
head.
At him.
That's how he's so overwhelmed, and it's all swirling around, and it's all
and
like,
then
oh
the
my
sequences
God,
where
the best moment of his life.
Yes,
and then
exactly.
The sequences where he's like there with them in the room, except he's not. It's not. It looks like they actually built a set that like was crunched together
to
look like
see
a
if
split
it was
scene.
Like
I couldn't find
or anything.
I couldn't
it was pretty
one.
Seamless, and I think most of it. Or they'll do a shot where you know. Somebody will go into a room and he'll go into a room, but they'll be reversed on either side. It's just a really smart way to get around this very conventional way of shooting a scene. And it's really good because, like I said, a huge portion of this movie is just Norman on the phone.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be exhausting just cutting back and forth all the time.
I mean, it's definitely a character piece. We're looking at a deep examination of this character who, by the end, we don't really know much about who he is or where he came from, but we know... we know important things about what motivates him.
We barely even see him, like, except for one scene without a jacket on.
Yeah.
That jacket.
He wears the same.
Well, he's almost always outside.
Yeah.
You know, he's practically homeless. We never really know. There's an insinuation that he inherited a small amount of money at some point.
And his mom's
a rent-controlled apartment.
Yeah.
But it also insinuates that perhaps he's living in the basement of a synagogue.
Yeah.
It's not really clear what it is, which is a good kind of ambiguity. As well, I feel like we should mention, we already mentioned some of the other really good actors in this.
Oh my gosh,
good turns.
Yes.
You mentioned Charlotte Gainsbourg has a really strong turn
she
in
really
here.
Does. As I want her to read me bedtime stories every night.
Oh,
yeah, she's somebody he meets on a train who's an agent who works for the Israeli government about when they have to deal with bringing criminals in or out of Israel or America, extradition. Dan Stevens, who apparently is in everything right now,
has a
fun role in here. The most fun, though, is by Hank Azaria, who has this great sequence where where the third act, where Richard is really paranoid that, you know, somebody's out to get him.
Yeah.
And he's sure it's Hank Azaria because he's just following around. He's spying him. He's there. He's everywhere. And it's clearly happening. When he finally confronts him, he's a younger him.
Yeah.
He's exactly him. It's almost like it's a dream. Like, that's not real.
You're
like,
not there really is no, sure if he's real if or he's, not.
Yeah. That's, if he's not just hallucinating this because he's so the younger version of him.
That's the only sequence that I found. I just really couldn't connect with that. I thought that was a little too on the nose for me. And it kind of like broke away from like
the... It was the only big open laugh in the film, which is what made it odd.
Yeah.
You know, where
yeah.
it was a direct, flat-out comedy sequence.
Yeah, like, But he did great in it. He nailed it. Well, I think everyone did, especially the actor who played Eshel. Yes, I thought he was Leo fantastic. Ashkenazi.
He's fantastic in this.
He really is. Know,
but that scene where he's talking to about clarifying his points.
Yeah, the president sends out, you know, an advisor or something. It's like, hey, we want to just confirm what you're going to be saying tomorrow. The backdrop to this and where the thriller element comes into play is Eshel, as we find out, when he meets Gere's character, when he meets Norman, he's kind of at a crossroads in his career. He's not sure if he's ever going to get anywhere, if he's ever destined for greatness, you know, and this one little act of kindness, you know, he promises he's going to help him out. He'll do it. And then he blows him off.
Yeah.
But within those 3 years, something happens that night where finally he tastes a little bit of quality.
Yeah.
He tastes a little bit, even though it's just represented in a pair of shoes. He's like, once you've had the best, you never want to go back.
True.
And that's kind of the, as trivial as that is, it's sort of the inciting moment that makes him go, you know what? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go for it and I'm going to advance my career.
It's interesting.
I want to go for the top job. And he wins on a platform of bringing peace to the Middle East.
It's interesting how many scenes in this movie with Eshel are punctuated by a close-up on the pair of shoes.
Yes.
Even if he's not wearing them, the camera will just go
They're
to
there.
Them and say, this is a moment. None of this would have happened without this moment.
Absolutely.
You know, it is interesting.
It's a great way to show symbolism.
And the Eshel character, as we find out, is very controversial because, you know, if you are kind of even remotely dovish about Middle Eastern politics, you know, and you start talking about peace,
it's a tough road.
There's going to be people who are going to be angry. And as things come out, you know, there are people who are willing to find embarrassing things in his past if that's what it takes to get him out of office. And Norman somehow intersects with all of these potentially strange connections.
Yeah.
Because people are going, how is it that this guy knows this guy who knows this guy? How are these people connected?
How could this possibly?
You know, how could all of these people know one another? And unbeknownst to himself, Norman is that guy. And how he resolves that issue and how he makes good by his promises or not is what this movie ultimately ends on. And to my surprise, even though the ending is telegraphed a bit, it's still satisfying. And that's where the tragedy comes in. But one thing I believe in is that good tragedy is not necessarily depressing, because there can be something uplifting even in tragedy, even in anonymity. But knowing that you're doing something for the right reasons, even if no one else will ever know you did it, we, the audience, know.
Yeah, isn't that the most noble kind of sacrifice? The one where you will never be credited for?
Right.
You know?
And that's so fitting with him, because he is the most, you know, he's the most self, you know, the least self-serving fixer I've ever seen.
Yeah. He's such a contradiction in terms in so many ways. You just don't know what to make of him until when it comes down, what happens, what makes a great man? Well, you never really know until everything is on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go to final thoughts. Frank, what do you say?
You know, I love I loved everything about this movie except for the on the nose, that one on the nose sequence, which even wasn't even too bad. But I think the ending is so inevitable, and I think the ending is sort of, it fits with the film. I think some people will find it sort of comical, you know, in terms of, you know, the manner in which stuff is actually happening. I think also people might just find it, you know, weirdly beautiful and touching at the same time.
I'm with you on that.
But, you know, that's in keeping with the rest of the film and its, you know, various tones, and with Norman and his various tones. I will say that everybody is great in this film. It's got so many, you know, really telling scenes that are not really to do with sort of right or left sides of life, but just complex, the gray area of life, which I think
there aren't any villains in this film.
There aren't really any villains. And even when Eshel, when he's sort of cuts ties with Norman, the way he cuts ties with Norman, I understood why he had to do that, and he did that for both of them.
Yeah,
I feel.
And you know? those two guys act so well together.
Yes.
But when you think about it, they basically have three meetings.
True.
Uh-huh.
One with the shoes, and after that, it's only ever and once after he's prime minister, and after that, it's only ever on the phone.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And it's only one phone call.
And it's one phone call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The two primary characters of this film, around which everything revolves, are actually kept separate.
Yeah, everything that happens in this film is either is about one of them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or the outcome of something that they did.
I mean, I went into this movie knowing nothing about it. All I knew was Richard Gere, and I thought, okay.
I want to touch on that.
And I was so, after a couple of days, I've seen three movies this week in 3 days in a row, and this is the best one, which surprised me.
It is. I agree.
It surprised me, and I'm still thinking about it, and it's a shame that it came out this time of the year, because I suspect that it's the kind of film that towards Oscar season would get a little buzz, especially for either original screenplay or for Richard Gere in particular. Mm-hmm. It's a little early, though.
They might sneak him in the Golden Globes, probably.
Maybe.
And this would be like one of the things they label as comedy now. But it's funny, I went to see this because of Richard Gere. Because I wrote an editorial recently about Richard Gere's career now, because people forget that when he started out, he was quite the risk taker.
Oh, that's a big thing back then.
Yeah. This is like in the 80s, and then Pretty Woman hit, and then he became his go-to.
He became a heartthrob.
Yeah, and it seemed like everything he tried to tackle had him romancing somebody. He did a Hitchcockian movie. He had to be in bed with Kim Basinger early half of it.
That was the last movie I saw him with, I think.
He played a man who had bipolar disorder. Well, he falls in love with his doctor.
Yeah.
So, but really, and then I think a couple of years ago, he was playing like second fiddle to Amelia Swank, and he did a movie with a dog.
Yeah.
He was in movie 43, and I thought, oh my God.
Yeah, but a lot of good people in movie 43 were like, that was a matter of weird sort of like, I would love to see a movie about the people who made movie 43, because apparently there was some degree of like blackmail. There was a lot of that one time we were at that party together, that thing happened. Hey, do you want to come do a scene in my movie? Apparently it was really shady as fuck. Getting these big stars for that, but
then whenever he did, straight from like something like Chicago or Unfaithful, it was always somebody else that was the star of like that sort of acclaim, and he just got the leftovers. Like when he played the Bob Dylan, everyone was about Cate Blanchett did it.
Cate Blanchett,
she stole that.
And Richard Gere was in there too, and like Chicago, Renee Zellweger.
Everybody was talking about Richard Gere in Chicago,
but he was the one that was nominated, was he?
True, but that tap dance was the best scene in the whole
movie. It was so great. Yeah. But since, in the last few years, he's really, been taking chances as an artist. He did that Antoine Fuqua movie.
Yeah.
Arbitrage, which is really good. He's got another movie called The Dinner. And
you were really interested to see
this
because
really,
of Richard
because,
Gere.
Yeah, he's really bold. He's taking chances now. He's playing these great characters that are just really testing him. And, the movie star is gone, and I'm loving it. And that's the reason I went to see this movie. And it also happens to be just one of the best movies I've seen so far this year.
Yeah.
I probably have to give it 9 out of 10 iPhones that he clings to, like it is his lifeline, essentially.
Marco?
I have to echo what Frank said, other than not being a big, knowing a lot about Richard Gere. But yeah, I mean, this movie has stuck with me for the past 3 days, and I really was glad to get to see it because it was not on my radar. And for all the reasons we've said, I think it's worth checking out. Even if it doesn't get nominated for anything, it's the kind of film that could and should. And, if you're listening to this and you're like us, you probably watch a bunch of crappy stuff. And you have a great time. We all love cheese. But you know what? This is a movie for grown-ups. This is a nice steak and a sensible size portions. You'll love this movie if you have any kind of heart. I give it 9 out of 10 peanuts.
I'm going to say you guys definitely like this movie more than I did, which isn't to dismiss this film on any level, because I do think this is a genuinely really good film. However, all that being said, it's also a hard sell all the way through the first act.
Yeah,
you're like, I was grinding my teeth going, what are we watching here? Like, what is the point of this film? It's just this guy wandering around, and you got to be prepped for a sizable period of just having no idea. Even well into the second act, I had no idea what the actual plot of this movie was supposed to be. You don't really know anything about this guy. You're like, he's just wandering around talking to people. Okay. But when everything starts to come together, you realize this is actually a fascinatingly constructed little piece here that is definitely, as you said, Marco, for grown-ups.
Yeah.
It's a very adult film. It's a very smart film that maybe does, in fact, ask too much of most audiences. And that's fine. I like that some films do that. Mm-hmm. But even so, like I said, even for me, and being ready to like this, it was hard for me to get into it. It wasn't until the end that I had really decided, okay, I like this
film. At what point was it?
But you wouldn't have liked it if all that groundwork hadn't been laid out.
About halfway through the second act, I was like, okay, I'm definitely starting to enjoy this. But that's a long ways to go before you know. But you also are retconning in your head everything you've seen before and understanding it on a different level. Mm. It's that type of film where, like, it's not till later when you realize what you've seen and who this person is and what was going on there that you really start to enjoy what you saw.
And you appreciate not how well structured it is.
All that being said, I'm going to give this 7.5 bags of chocolates that will probably go uneaten out of 10.
Oh, that's just like, oh, I want some chocolate.
I mean, I can't have sugar now. And I was just like, you motherfucker.
Oh, really?
You can have sugar and you're just going to leave that there?
That's just,
yeah, what is that? That's not right. If you have sugar, go ahead and eat it because you're lucky.
Totally.
Eat your sugar while you may.